The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to the first new Yes to Life show of 2018. I'm Robin Daly, your regular host for the show, which is a weekly investigation of what's new, what's working, and what shows promise in the field of integrative medicine for cancer. To do this, I'll be speaking to doctors, oncologists, practitioners, and thought leaders in the UK and around the world. And on that note, my first guest is truly inspirational. In fact, one of my personal inspirations right back when I was starting Yes to Life. I've never spoken to her before, so I'm really looking forward to this. If you have a serious medical situation and you're in need of direction and inspiration, then sit back and listen to Petrea King speaking to us from Australia.
Hi Petrea, it's a real delight to be talking to you today. I've known about your work for years. You've been an inspiration to me from the far side of the planet since I first heard about you right in the very early years of Yes to Life. So it's a really exciting opportunity to talk to you.
That's lovely, Robin. It's wonderful to be with you.
Great. So, as with many great initiatives to help people in need, your work and Quest for Life came as a direct result of your own personal experience. Could you sort of briefly tell us how you came to start on a journey that's ultimately helped so many people?
Yes, well, in many ways, it predates when I was diagnosed with leukemia in 1983, because as a young teenager, I had 3 years in hospital having multiple surgeries to my legs, orthopedic surgeries to straighten my legs. And during that time, I had hundreds of x-rays, which I suspect might have had something to do with me developing leukemia in my 30s. But during that time, I developed very serious osteoarthritis in both my knees and used to walk with walking sticks. So I got very interested in diet and nutrition and yoga and meditation as ways of really helping to contribute to my own physical well-being. So I started doing that really at quite an early age. In my teen years, I started meditating when I was 17. I'm now 66. And so when I was diagnosed with leukemia in 1983, I was told that I wouldn't see Christmas, which was 3 months away. And it was a very challenging and difficult time, not only for myself, but for my family, because my brother had just taken his life 18 months before I was diagnosed. And so we were still very much reeling from his death when I was diagnosed. And I think, to this day, I think that was still the hardest thing, was seeing the anguish on other people's faces and to realise that my death would cause so much more pain to people. I think I found that the most challenging part of the whole journey. But obviously I didn't die, because I'm still very much here and alive and full of good health.
Great.
When I came back from Italy, I had all the blood tests again. I'd spent some time in a little monastery in a cave outside of Assisi where St. Francis used to retreat to for prayer and meditation. And I spent 18 hours a day in that little cave for several months. And it was there really that my whole life ground to a halt, and I really started dealing with some of the emotional issues that I'd long held suppressed. Because in our family, no matter what happened, you had to look good and no one talked about how they felt. And so I had this highly polished facade, but behind that lay a very different story. And I wasn't at peace with myself. I wasn't at peace with my history. I wasn't at peace with the world. So during that time in that I spent several months in that cave, that was really where I first of all started just weeping, because up until when I was 33, I'd never cried, because in our family, crying was definitely not on either. And now, of course, we say it's very hard to kiss someone who's keeping a stiff upper lip. And I think at that time, I was just at pains to deflect any attention from myself and have every conversation really be about other people rather than about myself. So when I came back to Australia, I had all the blood tests again, and the doctors were nonplussed. They said I wasn't meant to have a remission, and that the remission that I did have wouldn't last. And I found that actually more difficult, because I had my whole life all packed up in this little suitcase all ready for the big trip, and then the plane got cancelled, and I was faced with how much do you unpack the suitcase? How do you live skillfully with uncertainty and not knowing when you're, it's a bit like living in the transit lounge of life, waiting for your number to get called up. And I found that very uncomfortable. And then I rang a friend who, he owns a very large vitamin company in Australia, and I'd known him for many years. And it was him who said to me, forget what the doctor said, because they said my remission might only last a few days or a few weeks. Go into practice as a naturopath, which is what I was trained to do. I was a naturopath and a herbalist and a yoga and meditation teacher. And he put me together with a doctor who was looking for a naturopath to go into practice with. And within the first 2 weeks, the first woman with breast cancer came in. The day after, the first person with AIDS came in. And my question to people has always been, what is it that stands in the way of you being at peace? And sometimes it was nausea or pain or sleeplessness or diarrhea. So we fix whatever the problem was with dietary changes or the addition of supplements or things like slippery elm powder, which is a wonderful substance. So we'd address whatever the symptom was, and then those conversations got ever deeper into the existential questions of who are you? What are you doing on the planet? Are you living the life you came here to live? If not, why not? And what are you going to do about it? And of course, I found those conversations deeply enriching both for the person and for myself. And now some 120,000 conversations later, I haven't lost my passion and my joy in really seeing people recognize that they do have choices and that they can make a significant contribution to their own physical, mental, emotional and spiritual health and well-being.
Wow. Well, I can hear that passion, and so much in what you've just said. I just want to go back to when you were talking about your time in the cave there. You talked about your life grinding to a halt, and that was something that most people would see as a sort of negative, but actually you were talking about it there in a kind of positive way, in that the momentum of your past life kind of burnt out, and you were able to maybe see in a way you weren't able to before.
Yes, and of course, no doubt, as you found, Robin, so often people have been through some major trauma in the 18 months to 2 years, 3 years before a diagnosis of illness, of serious illness, and that's not just cancer, it can be other illnesses too, of course. But I think, you know, when your immune system's a bit depleted because of grief or because of pregnancy for some people and because of other things that have put a bit of a strain on your physicality, your vitality, those are the very times when it seems that we are more susceptible to developing illnesses. And that's why I think to only treat the disease and not to take into account the person in a very whole person way is to only do the minimum amount for healing, because healing is really about peace. Curing is about the body. And I've known many people who were cured of their disease, but they're still very much in need of healing. And I've known other people who died of their disease, but they were healed of every fear and every anxiety before they died. So to me, You know, I would never say to someone, you know, you must drink your juice and eat a fabulous organic diet and meditate and forgive everyone so that you don't die.
Right.
By all means, drink your juice, eat a fabulous organic diet, meditate, forgive everyone so you live today well. And then, of course, your focus is on how do I live today well rather than how do I prevent myself from dying.
Yeah, very different focus. Interesting.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, and something else you mentioned was this transition between the way you had been living and living with uncertainty, which seems to me such a big point. You describe it almost as like a completely foreign land, a completely different way of being. But, of course, it's in line with the reality, you know, the certainty we all tend to live with generally. We've made it up anyway.
That's exactly right. But you see, I grew up with a very chaotic brother who probably invented ADHD 20 years before anyone knew what that was.
Oh,
but Brendan, my brother, told me before I was 10 that he knew he had to kill himself by the time he was 30.
Wow.
And so I was very, very tiny for my age. And I remember thinking at the time, that's why I'm alive. I'm here to keep Brendan safe. I have to grow up really quickly so I can look after Brendan after he told me this. And interestingly, in the next 15 months, I grew 23 centimetres or 9 inches, and that's what deranged the bone growth in my legs, and my knees swiveled in and started dislocating and I could no longer walk. And so that's how I ended up in hospital then, virtually for 3 years, having my legs straightened again. So I think the mind is actually incredibly powerful. And I think in our family, I think I grew up very much believing that you can't trust life, you mustn't trust life, you have to earn your right to exist. And so I was always striving, always hard on myself, always, you know, I did 30-day fasts, I did 40-day fasts, I did a 60-day fast.
Wow.
This is back in my 20s. I was very, very hard and rigid on myself. And I think that core belief of I have to earn my right to exist impelled a lot of those behaviours. And so it was not until I was in the cave and I began to weep those many, many tears, and my first book really, instead of Quest for Life, really should have been called Sob Your Way to Health, that it probably wouldn't have been as popular.
No, it wouldn't have sold
but,
so well.
In that weeping, I realised that some of these core beliefs that I clung to as if my life depended on it were actually killing me.
Mm.
And to learn... So, for instance, you know, at the time when I was in the cave in Italy, I'd been a very strict vegetarian for 15 years. I'd been a meditator for 15 years. And the priest who was looking after me, the very first night I came up, he came down into the cave and dragged me upstairs and sat me at a table. And he put in front of me a meal that he prepared himself, and there was meat in it. And I hadn't eaten meat for 15 years. There was a big chunk of white bread, and as a naturopath, I'd been saying for years, the whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead. And so I hadn't, you know, I was against white bread. There was a goblet of red wine. I hadn't drunk wine for 15 years. So it was suddenly like my whole belief system on the platter in front of me.
Yeah.
And I realized that for me, it was more healing to be grateful for what he'd lovingly prepared for me, a stranger, than for me to cling to a belief that says, no, I have to eat this rigid diet in order to live, when clearly here I was on a mountaintop in Italy, away from everyone I loved, and dying. So I realized that my mind got in the way a lot of the time of me actually accepting healing. And so I did find it very difficult to eat much of that meal, but I realised in that moment I know zip about anything. You know, for all my studying, for all my qualifications, I know zip about life and about trusting life.
Right.
And so there were little moments like that of healing that were quite profound moments where I let go of a lot of rigidity and hardness that I held myself accountable to.
Mm. Well, that was some insight, I'd say.
And it doesn't seem it's not common. I see. In fact, it's so interesting. When we run retreats for people with cancer, this is just a very simple way of looking at it. When we run retreats for people with cancer, they go into our little shop and they buy gifts for other people. When we run programs, retreats for people with depression, anxiety, loss, grief, they buy resources from the shop for themselves.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's just really interesting that we notice in the shop people with cancer are always thinking about other people and always focused on the needs of other people, whereas a lot of other people are not.
Right, that's a very interesting observation.
Well, I think a lot of people have said that people with cancer are the nice people, you know, the people who can't say no, people who say, yes, I'll be there, yes, I'll do that.
That's true, it does get...
I don't know if that's so in England, but it's certainly so here in Australia.
No, it's certainly been noticed by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so some of these insights you had about yourself and your own family and about your relationship to life... would you say these are the central resources you've been able to bring to other people?
Well, yes, but I think, you know, I had nursing in my background as well, so I found that very useful because I had a medical understanding of the treatments that people were on, because I think that's important too. For instance, if someone's going through radiotherapy, they may find that they're suddenly terribly tearful, and they're wondering why they're in tears all the time. It's really useful to know, look, that's a direct side effect of the treatment that you're having.
Right.
You're not losing the plot, you're not depressed, you're not, you know, so it's very helpful to have that medical understanding as well. But then also the naturopathic things, because, you know, whilst dietitians understand a great deal about food and the components of food, they don't actually study the effect that food has on the body. So, for instance, if anything's going to make you nauseous, it's oranges and orange juice. The liver loves grapefruit, lemons, limes, mandarins, likes all of those, but it doesn't like oranges. And if you feel nauseous because you're having treatment, then you're probably best to avoid orange juice. And yet we still serve orange juice alongside of chemotherapy in every hospital around Australia.
Right.
That level of common sense that if anything's going to make you throw up, it's orange juice. So why would you give that to someone who's having chemotherapy? Or they may send a person with a potential bowel blockage home from hospital and tell them to eat lots of cheese and eggs. And yet we all know that cheese was called bung in the Second World War for a really good reason.
Right.
And so saying to someone who's just had a bowel blockage and who no doubt is on high levels of pain medication as well, to eat a constipating food like cheese is really silly. Mm. So I think understanding the naturopathic principles, understanding the medical perspective and the impact that treatments have on people, and then, you know, the many years of meditation that I've had and the studying of yogic principles and philosophy, all of those things have really been tremendously helpful in meeting people where they are, in the depths of wherever they might be, dealing with their fears and anxieties and despairs and so on. So ours isn't a program about, you know, do this and you might not die.
Mm-hmm.
Our program is very much about what do you need to do today to live really well and to align yourself with life. So through what you eat, what you think, how you manage your mind, how you manage your emotions, how you communicate, how are you going to align yourself so much with life that life flows through you and that vitality is profoundly healing in itself.
Mm.
There's sort of a frenetic energy around people who are doing a million and one things to not die.
Right.
You know, people who get themselves quite anxious because they only had two juices last Thursday instead of three, you know, and worrying about that. And I find instead that peace of mind is the most dynamic and powerful foundation for healing that we can cultivate.
Sounds marvellous. So I'd like to look a little bit more into the kind of opportunities that are inherent in a crisis such as cancer, something, you know, you seem to believe very strongly. And some people, they get understandably angry when someone starts trying to tell them about a kind of silver lining to what, by any standards, is a personal disaster. you're very well qualified to talk on this subject, as you're able to speak from your own first-hand experience. So I wonder if you could start by describing the potential of these existential challenges within the context of someone's whole life journey.
Yes. Look, if it's yourself, you know, we need to make a lot of these discoveries for ourselves, and having someone from outside of us, you know, tell us, you know, you created this illness so that you could learn spiritual lessons, which is a common one that a lot of people say, you know, that you created your disease so that you could learn these wonderful and profound lessons about life. And I, like everybody else, don't remember the day where we sat down and thought, oh, yes, a bit of cancer right now would be terrific. I'd learn so much. However, having said that, I think these are the things that you need to be able to discover for yourself. So for yourself, if you're willing to dismantle some of your beliefs and learn to trust life and learn to trust your body again, because a lot of people lose confidence in their body when it's been unwell, and really understand how your body works and how to nourish it, and that your brain is plastic, and the brain you take to bed tonight won't be the brain that you woke up with this morning. So we can be masters of our own journey through illness and not be a helpless victim of it. And I think, you know, once you get to a place where you can say, that's it, something has to change, and it's me. I can't change the diagnosis that I've had, but I can change who I'm going to be in relation to that diagnosis. Am I going to be defined by that diagnosis, or can I be more than that? And I think that's the challenge that we all face when we have a significant or serious illness. If you love someone, then please just listen to that person. You may want to say to them, you know, I'm just itching to research, to look for therapies that might be of benefit to you, but you need to let me know if that's what you want me to do, rather than go off gung-ho and say, you know, look, you've got to change your diet and you've got to meditate for 3 hours and you've got to do this, that and the other. And then that just becomes overwhelming for someone. So we need to help people. And as I said, my question to people has always been, what is it that stands in the way of you being at peace? And if that's a physical symptom, terrific, then let's address that. You know, if it's diarrhea, for instance, okay, the things that contribute to diarrhea are oranges, orange juice, fried fatty foods, fats, oils, alcohol, fried eggs, cheese, dairy products. So let's leave out those foods if you've got nausea or diarrhea because they contribute to it. So if you educate people, then they've got a choice, you know, okay, I can choose to have the orange juice and know that I might be nauseous, or now I'm educated, I might choose not to have it. So I think if you're journeying with someone who has an illness, you wanting them to be different from who they are is a sure pathway to misery. Your job, if you love someone, is to support them, to listen to them, and to help them find their own best answers, rather than impose your best answers on another person. So I think these things are often best discovered by ourselves as we journey through the experience of cancer. The other thing too is that we may not be ready to change our diet this week, but in 3 weeks' time, I might be absolutely ready to hear about it then. So what works 1 week might not work another, and we need to have that flexibility to be able to embrace each moment, preferably with a quiet mind, so that we have access to our intuition, wisdom, humour, spontaneity, creativity and compassion, because those are all present time qualities. And the moment the brain is entrained by being focused in the present moment, we have access to all of those really valuable qualities. Whereas when the brain is unmanaged and it's full of telling you stories about the future, all the things that might happen, could happen, probably won't happen, or it's regurgitating the past and it's blaming and shaming and resenting and rewriting history about the past, whenever your brain is caught up telling you stories about the future or the past, you're creating a physiology in accordance with whatever it is that you're thinking. So if you're anxious, fearful, frustrated, regretting, shameful, blaming, that's not just a state of mind, it's a physiology that you're creating in your body. Whereas the chemistry, when the brain is entrained and focused wholeheartedly in the present moment, where you have access to intuition, insight, wisdom, humour, spontaneity, creativity and compassion, then those qualities are far more beneficial at a physiological level for healing.
Well, yes, I think many of those things you've just described are the kind of things that a lot of people are desperate to access, if you like. And I was talking about,
that's right.
A challenge like this within the context of a whole life's journey, presenting an opportunity. Well, I think maybe it's an opportunity to have a taste of those things, maybe for the first time.
Yes, often for the first time.
Yeah, it's interesting that in a way you describe the kind of direction that the mind so often takes us with the future and the past and all that worry about things that you think are going to happen but actually never do, all that sort of thing. In a way, something mm-hmm. like cancer turns the volume up on all those things. It's like, it takes us to a crisis simply by amplifying the background chatter of life, that distracts us all the time. To a crescendo that is a crisis, and maybe gives us the opportunity to step back from it for a second and see it for what it is.
Yes, exactly, and that's exactly right, Robin. And of course, once you have a diagnosis of a serious illness, then, as you say, your fears and anxieties tend to become amplified at that time rather than finding that inner equilibrium at the very time when we need it the most.
Mm. Yeah, so interestingly, these kind of things that we're talking about, the nitty-gritty of the spiritual journey, which is, there's a lot of people out there, there's a mass of guidance and practices, and you in a way are stepping in at this sort of crisis moment with the kind of resources that somebody who is helping to guide people on a spiritual journey might bring along. And the people who are much more directly involved in spiritual work tend to have resources that they bring. There may be practices or techniques or whatever that they bring along to support someone in discovering these aspects of themselves. Do you also rely on some techniques and practices?
To me, all of this work is spiritual work because it's about reconnecting people with their essential nature. When we first arrive here on the planet, our brains are not fully wired up because we've only just arrived. And the brain is wired up not according to what we think, but according to how we feel. And we gradually begin to lay down these neuronal pathways in the brain. We get seduced into the I'll be happy when story. And we hear our parents, I'll be happy when you get a pay rise. I'll be happy when we go on holidays. And before long, I'll be happy when I turn 5. I'll be happy when I go to school. I'll be happy when Christmas comes. I'll be happy when I leave school. I'll be happy when I get my qualification. Happy when I get married. Happy when I have children. Happy when they leave. Happy when the divorce comes through. And so we're deeply programmed from a very early age to postpone our sense of contentment and happiness to a future time when things look different from how they are right now. And you'll hear people, I'll be happy when my hair grows back, I'll be happy when I get my energy back, I'll be happy when I'm off the crutches or whatever it might be. We're also finding our way into our physical body. We have to get our physical body up and running. We've got to find our way into the dynamics of our own particular family, and we might begin to practice a particular persona that works within the dynamics of our own particular family.
Yes.
I practice being invisible because my brother pretty much filled the space.
Yes.
Another person might practice being the peacemaker or the responsible one or the sickly one, the bright one, the pretty one, the academic one. Now, And then we also are taking on our family's prejudices unconsciously. Mm. And this is where little children learn about these people belong to us and then there's the others. Right. And all of that's gone in by the time we're three. Mm. So it's gone in long before we've got any conscious understanding of what's taken place. And it becomes second nature for us to act and believe in a particular way. And it's interesting that people say, oh, it's second nature for me to think like this, feel like this, react like this, because no one ever questions, well, what's your first nature? What was there before you took on the anxieties, the beliefs, the limitations? And, of course, it's often not until you bump into a D in life, a drama, a disappointment, a disaster, a diagnosis, a death, a divorce, a disease, a daughter, a dad, a drought, a downturn, and there's a whole lot of D's. And when you bump into that D, everything that's second nature to you doesn't work. So it might be second nature to you to blame other people for your unhappiness. It might be second nature to you to isolate and to go into an old pattern of I do it myself. It might be second nature to you to sleep all the time or not sleep or eat all the time or not eat. But this D demands more from you than you've ever had to draw on. Right. And you get to that fabulous place that we were talking about before where you say, that's it, something has to change and it's me. I want peace more than being right, more than hanging on to resentment or blame. I want peace more than a cure. And once you get to that place, everything changes because what you're saying is I'm willing to see things differently.
Right.
And I'm willing to return to my essential nature rather than keep on hanging on to what's become second nature to me. And so then we begin that return journey and we find that there are four particular qualities that people who don't die when they were meant to, you know, if they don't die on time, and bear in mind, doctors only work in quarterly installments. You're always given 3 to 6 or 6 to 12 or 12 to 18 because they're talking about a statistical group of people. They're talking about thousands of people. They're never talking about you as an individual because they haven't a clue whether you're going to be in the average or not. So once, when I looked at all of the people who, with my memoir just coming out, I've been travelling around the country and I've met many, many people who came to see me in the 80s, in 1985 or 6, when they were given 3 months to live, and they're still here. And it's just been such a joy in meeting all of these people who are now grandparents and yet they were given 3 months to live in their 30s or 20s or whatever. So it's incredibly gratifying, and they all have four qualities in common. Okay. They don't do four things in common. And I can go through them just very, very quickly. That they're outlined in one of my books, which is called Your Life Matters, and also my which we can send from Australia to any of your listeners. And I believe my memoir, which is called Up Until Now, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. I know it's just been released in England as well. And there are many, many stories in that one. But these four qualities are universal. And then what I found was they were universal whether you were grieving or dealing with depression, anxiety, loss, grief, anything, because they're about peace. So the first is if you want peace, you need to regain control over your response to life. That first C is the difference between feeling a hapless, helpless victim of your circumstance or feeling like an empowered co-creator.
Right.
So you might have to weep about it, rail about it, scream about it, write about it until you can say, yes, this did happen and it happened to me. And given I'm a woman in this circumstance, what's an appropriate response? Now, that could be for one person to get a second opinion. For another, it could be my partner and I need to have that really difficult conversation we keep avoiding. For another person, it could be I need to find out how I'm going to sleep better now that I'm in this situation, or how do I improve my nutrition? But regain control over your response. The first C is the difference between a reaction and a response. Right. A reaction's always in the body. It's in the gut, it's in the heart rate, it's in the breathing, it's in the sweaty palms. A response takes you into new territory.
Okay.
The second C is a commitment to living, and that's about having a deep reverence for our life, to really honour the life that we have, and we do that by what we eat and how we take care of ourselves, how we communicate with ourselves and with others, how we forgive and learn from life's lessons. So commitment to living is caring enough about your life to do whatever you need to do to care for yourself physically, mentally, emotionally and spiritually, be in clear communication with yourself and others, and be able to forgive and let go traumas from the past. Third C is about a sense of challenge. How are we going to make meaning out of what's happened to us? And a lot of us, of course, make meaning out of our suffering by maybe creating a service for others so that other people might suffer less, or by changing the law, or by volunteering, or all sorts of different ways. And the fourth C is about our sense of connectedness, that we have a deep sense of connection to our innate first nature, that we feel that we've got our friends, our mates, our family, that we've got our sense of place, of belonging, that we belong to nature, to the cycles, to the cosmos, but we have our sense of place. And when you look at the absence of those four C's, if you imagine a person with cancer who feels completely out of control with their life and they can only helplessly react to everything that happens to them as if they're a victim, that their commitment to living is all around, I'll be happy at another time when things are different from how they are right now, that they're not in looking after themselves physically, mentally, emotionally or spiritually, they're not in clear communication with themselves or anyone else, they have no capacity to forgive, and they keep blaming the past for how they feel in the present, that all their challenges are overwhelming and nothing has meaning for them, and they have no sense of connection to themselves or to anyone else, I think common sense would tell us that that person wouldn't fare nearly as well as one for whom the opposite is true. And in my experience, in the 120,000 people I've seen over the last 32 years, those four qualities that we need to know, regardless of how challenging, how difficult, how complex things might get outside of ourselves or even in our physical body, they don't have to disturb our inner equilibrium from which we can respond moment by moment. And we can do that because we've taken good care of our physical, mental, emotional and spiritual health and well-being. Mm-hmm. We're in clear communion with ourselves and with one another, can forgive and let go what happened in the past, that every moment becomes a sacred moment, and that we feel a powerful sense of connection to our own innate spirit, to the spirit that enlivens all creation, all people, all things, then I think we can begin to see how at that epigenetic level we're changing the physiology around the cell. And of course we know that if you change the environment around the cell, and we do that through nutrition, exercise, how we sleep, the chemicals of our emotions and the environmental toxins that we're exposed to, that's what's in the environment around the cell, along with the hormones. If we change that environment, we may very well begin to suppress some of the genes that have been expressing themselves that have led to our ill health. And that's why I think we see people actually regain their health, or, you know, when you find that deep sense of peace within yourself, when you're nourishing yourself appropriately, when you're aligning yourself with life, then that's, in my experience, that's where the miracles happen. That's where the unexpected happens. And I think we need to encourage people that you're far more powerful than you might know, and that you can make a huge difference to your own health by taking back control over how you're going to nourish yourself, rest, exercise, keep your brain quiet and entrained, and through things like meditation and mindfulness and so on.
Mm, Well, amazing. You painted such a clear picture there. It's obviously gained from your many decades of supporting people, of this whole relationship to life that you're trying to cultivate in people. And I'm so interested that at the end of that, you were talking all about, you know, people's inner being, if you like, in all those four qualities. But then suddenly you connected those to the outer world and the experience of the physical body's health and everything, which, of course, is one of the fascinating things to emerge in research over the last two or three decades, is just how connected these things really
exactly.
are. And how these things express yes. themselves in our lives and in our health.
Yes. Look, I had an experience when I was about 7 years old where I saw the invisible world as being far more substantial than the material world.
Mm.
And I never lost the power of that experience. I was only 7 years old when I had it. But I know that it's the invisible world that's the eternal world. The world of energy is the eternal world. Anything that's physical is transient. And, of course, that does include our physical bodies. But the peace that passes all understanding is really when you've anchored your sense of self in that which is beyond change, in your awareness.
Mm.
Because your body, even if you live to 110, it'll get saggy and baggy and wrinkly and grey. And if you think that's who you are, it could be disappointing.
Mm.
If you think you're your brain, your mind, well, that's a bit of a dog's breakfast a good deal of the time. It's all over the place. So you need to quieten that down. If you think you're your feelings, well, they change all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when you anchor your sense of self in your awareness, which is beyond what's going on in the body, beyond what's going on in the brain, and in the fluctuating thoughts and feelings, that's where real peace lies. And when you find that, frankly, you know, my preference was to live. But if you're addicted to living, I can only have peace if I don't die,
right.
You could be in very tricky territory.
Right.
Yeah. If you prefer, I would absolutely prefer to remain here on earth with my children, my parents, my life, but my peace is not dependent on that, then that's a liberation that's incredibly powerful and, I believe, too, incredibly healing. So we are far more powerful than we know. We are a spark of that life that flows through us. And when we nourish ourselves, when we put ourselves in environments that are conducive to bringing more life into our world, into our body, into our life, then, of course, that's going to be much more healing than feeling overwhelmed, frustrated, frightened, anxious, hopeless, powerless, helpless, and all of those other things that we can sometimes feel too.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Yeah, we're getting towards the end of the show. Can we just come back to what you've built up over the years, your Quest for Life Centre, all the resources that you offer to people, both who are able to reach your centre and further afield. Could you just sort of summarise the main things that you're offering to people?
Certainly, yes. We have a beautiful 35-bed guest house on 9 acres in a tiny little town of Bundanoon in the countryside. We're at about 7,000 metres here, so we get four distinct seasons. It's known as being a little bit like a little slice of England. And we run three programs, each of which are 5 days in length. There's Quest for Life, which is based around my book of the same name, which is for people who are dealing with physical illnesses, so chronic pain, cancer, Parkinson's, MND, MS, all of those various significant illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
We have another program called Healing Your Life, and that's based on my book, Your Life Matters, and that really unpacks those four C's that I was talking about.
Yes.
And that's for people who are living with depression, anxiety, grief, loss, trauma, or the consequences of past abuse. And then the third program we have is called Moving Beyond Trauma, and that's for people who have PTSD or post-trauma stress symptoms. So we get a lot of police and first responders and veterans and victims and witnesses of crime or terrorism or domestic violence, sexual abuse, sexual assault. A lot of those people come on that third program. And we run about 25 of those programs each year. And, you know, people often arrive on a Monday feeling despondent and anxious. And it's just so inspiring to see the capacities of the human spirit to embrace whatever the challenge is that they have. And by the time they leave on Friday, they're usually laughing and, in fact, they're always laughing and feeling like I can do my life and I know exactly what I need to do.
Wonderful.
And it's not because we tell people what we think they should do, but we help people to find their own best answers. Mm. And, of course, we do give people a lot of education about epigenetics, about the environment around the cell and neuroplasticity and how we can change our thinking and change our feelings. So it's a very comprehensive and quite an intensive course over 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, we run about 80 workshops in the community in towns where there's been a lot of maybe natural disasters or grief or loss or cancer or trauma of different kinds. And our work's really about resilience and healing and how do we reconnect people with the capacities of their own human spirit so that they can embrace the challenges that they have.
Mm. And if obviously a lot of our listeners are here in the UK, what resources do you have for people who are further afield?
Our webpage has quite a few articles and our Facebook page is a very, very interactive community. So any of your listeners might like to join our Facebook page.
Sure, yeah.
Also, once a month, we have what we call Quest Connect, which is one of our senior facilitators through the Facebook page speaking on various aspects of our program live. So that's for an hour on a Sunday afternoon. I'm not quite sure where that might translate time-wise to people in England. But there are also many, many podcasts because I do regular spots on radio as well. And there are dozens of podcasts on our website as well that people might find helpful too. There's also information about how to communicate around difficult subjects. There's information if you have a friend or a loved one who's been diagnosed with cancer. So our website, which is questforlife.com.au, is a good resource place for people. And then there are ways of people connecting with us live through those other avenues that I've mentioned. We've had people also come out from England to our programs too.
Imagine.
And, of course, they're very welcome to do that, although I know it's a very long way.
Well, it's very inspiring what you're offering, and I can imagine somebody making that journey to find some answers, you know. So, do you ever come to the UK or do you have...
Yes, indeed. I love coming to the UK. I haven't been for many, many years, but it's in my memoir as well. But I actually worked as nanny to the Churchill family, Winston Churchill's...
Wow.
Well, they were Sir Winston Churchill's great-grandchildren.
Yes.
But I lived for a year in England when I was about 20, 21, and have been back many times since and always very happy to come for if there's work there as well. If there's enough interest, I'd be very happy to come.
Mm. Well, do let me know if you're heading this way. Look, it's been really
inspiring
to talk to you today. I mean, you know, your passion just oozes out of you for this work, and I can tell how much you love what you're doing. And it's astonishing what you've managed to achieve as well. Really nice to be able to talk to you. I've sort of known of you for so long, but to actually talk to you directly is a real pleasure. And I thank you very much for giving us this time today.
Oh, you're very welcome, Robin. I'm always happy to chat with you. It's so easy these days with phones and Skype and whatever. So feel free to be in touch any time at all. And I wish all of our listeners the very best for 2018. May you all enjoy good health, happiness and healing.
Thank you, Petraea.
Thank you, Robin.
You definitely get the impression of an unstoppable force at work in the form of Petraea. And it's important to remember that, Although many of the concepts she's been speaking about today are reasonably common currency now, 30 years ago, when she started, she was an out-and-out radical pioneer. She must surely take a good chunk of the credit for that significant shift in our collective mindset. Links to resources mentioned in the show are on the Yes to Life show information page on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Just click the show logo that's on the homepage. I hope you enjoyed the show and will want to join me again next week when I'll be investigating a German blood analysis test with Professor Pachmann. Goodbye.